This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means we take some time to dive beneath the headlines. And this week, we tackle the troubling news around Boston's public schools. From a damaging report released by the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, summarized here by Education Commissioner Jeffrey Riley.
We've got a major transportation problem. We've got a facilities issue. We've got issues with special education, ELL. I mean, there's some serious concerns in this report.
And that list of issues has some, like DESE board member Matt Hills, calling for the district to enter state receivership.
If God was superintendent, God would need receivership to be effective here.
But that is a move that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu says she would fight.
If the commissioner does put forward a proposal for the board to designate and take over the Boston Public Schools, we will be requesting a hearing and due process under the board's laws and regulations to continue to make our case.
Now, regardless of where you stand on receivership, there is no denying that the district has faced some serious issues. Recently, the district closed the Mission Hill K-8 school over pervasive bullying and sexual misconduct issues, a decision that left some parents pretty frustrated, as one told WCVB.
If they had told people earlier and given us the information, people could have made plans. Now people can't even look at private schools, even if that is an option for you. It's too late.
Families of nearly 200 students now scrambling to find an option for next fall. And on top of all that, we've seen a dozen guns found in Boston public schools since September. Four of those in the last month or so. Suffolk County DA, interim Suffolk County DA Kevin Hayden acknowledges it as a problem.
We know that we have way too many guns on our streets right now. And so we're seeing that play out where it's reaching everywhere. It's even reaching into our schools.
And all of that comes as the district continues searching for its third superintendent in the last 7 years, fifth in the last 10. Lots to unpack, and here to help us do it, former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Tito, I'm going to ask you straight up, the headline in your mind about the Boston Public Schools right now, what is it?
The Boston Public Schools has had too many leadership changes in the past 10 years. Consistency has been an issue. I believe that receivership is absolutely not where we should be headed, but we are in need of partnership. And that's really what should actually be happening. Let's also be honest about the time in which we're having this conversation, right after COVID. Right. I do want to give Brenda Casilius her props.
Current superintendent.
The Mission Hill School needed to be closed. And by the way, it needed to be closed many years before this year. Those incidents happened not actually on her watch, but sadly that culture had festered for a long period of time. The issues around the exam schools and access to exam schools, that actually got done. One of the things that frustrated me beyond no end when I was chair of the education committee was the fact that our high schools and Boston Public Schools did not have a common requirement in terms of graduation. So if you move from one school to another school, you may not actually be able to graduate. That's another thing that she did get done.
And they didn't match necessarily the matriculation requirements for the public universities here in the state either.
To get to college, right? So you were literally setting people up for failure. And by the way, some schools setting them up for failure, some schools setting them up for success. There's a lot of work to do, and in particular, the partnership needs to happen, in particular, in the areas of English language learners, as well as our special education people.
Okay, so a couple things there. I do want to note that the memo that that DESE sent did not actually wind up proposing receivership, and Mayor Wu's counterproposal, which they're continuing to go back and forth on, she does frame it as partnership between the state and DESE. I want to pick up more. You just gave a litany of challenges that date back. So you served in the city council till 2017, left in early 2017 to run for mayor. Then and now,
Hold on, don't kick me out. I didn't leave until 2018.
Ran in 2017. That's right. I'm like, Craig, get these dates right.
No, it's
get
all
these
good.
Dates right. But when you ran, the question is, then and now, mm-hmm. are the Boston Public Schools better or worse now than they were then?
Yeah, so I would say invariably, schools as a whole having young people having missed a year and a half. By the way, that's not only Boston Public Schools. Those are schools across the state. The impacts of COVID, and in particular, the socio-emotional impacts of COVID for all young people, I believe, stunted growth. So I believe that we are in a worse situation. At that time, one of the things that I you know, beat the drum on a regular basis was two-thirds of the Boston Public Schools, we have 125 buildings, two-thirds of them were built before 1945. So the physical infrastructure has been a real issue. And that's something, by the way, I believe that the state could partner with us on. And they have a checkbook that's actually larger than our own checkbook. So that's one other component. I believe also now, and it was addressed earlier, the issues around violence and the like, those are also exacerbated by what has been going on. But I also am optimistic about parents. And the community being able to step forward and have more input in the direction. One, the City of Boston and the City Council has thoughtfully put forward legislation to change the school committee and actually have remember, there's 351 cities and towns in the state of Massachusetts. There is only one that has a mayorally appointed school committee. And that is the City of Boston. And I believe we would be in a better situation there. But the other issues also that one that has been settled is that at least now there is a transportation, there's a contract with the bus drivers, which was something that had been unsettled for a long time. So there's a lot going on here.
There's like a million things.
Yes.
Right? All right. So first, Mayor Wu is asking for another $10 million from the state to partner. The city is already receiving hundreds of millions of dollars, ARPA funds. Why is another tranche of money important?
So
I mean, one might say maybe it's not.
Yeah. So when you look at in particular, the physical plant of the buildings, and Tiziana, I'd love to walk you around some of the buildings in the City of Boston. They are falling down, and so having 125 antiquated buildings, many of them that the kids can't drink water out of the wall.
Bathrooms aren't functioning appropriately.
And they weren't built for 21st century education. 125 buildings, and I know Mayor Wu has talked about $2 billion. If you talk to people who build buildings, that for 125 actual buildings, that's not a whole lot of money.
Yeah, and to note, so she's announced essentially a capital improvement project of $2 billion to go into schools. And that is a question, right? So if that's the level of infrastructure decrepitude that we're dealing with, then what amount of money possibly could be enough? I do wonder. I mean, you are laying out this litany that is racked and stacked over time and that I think would resonate actually with people in a lot of school districts around the state.
Mm-hmm.
What, I don't want to be nihilistic, but is it doable to fix this stuff?
We actually, 100% of our future in the City of Boston is in the young people. Not saying that we're past tense, but when it comes down to it, those are the futurists and those are the people who have to be here. We found money to do the big dig in the state of Massachusetts. If we can find money to do a highway, to carry people forward, we can find the money to build the infrastructure for our young people. We need the wraparound services, counselors.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about the cultures in the schools?
Yes. So we cultures as well as resources in the schools. And I don't even get into the fact that some places don't have, as some of the young people call it TP, which is toilet paper.
Right.
But we need counselors. There has been an extension of nurses. There used to be half a nurse in each school. Nurses are amazing people. I know that they can't be in two places at one time. So that is an addition. And in particular for our most vulnerable students. So these are our special education students. And also we have a large population of English language learner students. But then in Boston, we have actually another population that many other cities and towns don't have. And they're called SIFE students. So these are students with interrupted formal education, mm-hmm. oftentimes coming from places where there were agrarian cultures where kids would miss 5, 6, 7 years of school. So they have no language, no written skills. These are those challenges that I believe that the state, and I would like to see the state partner with the city of Boston on in helping us get to where we need to be. Last, receivership has not worked in Southbridge, in Lawrence, and in Holyoke. And so to think that the state could take over the largest district in the state with a $1.4 billion budget, I don't believe that is the play. But I do believe the parents have to have the say. And by the way, there are really intelligent students who need to be at the table in this transformation. This can't be something that happens from on high. It has to be about partnership. It has to be about rolling our sleeves up and actually adults doing what need to be done to ensure young people get the opportunity that they need.
All right. That is Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, also one of the inaugural members of the new Boston Commission on Black Men and Boys. Thank you, Tito.
Thank you.
All right. Listen, we wanted to ask Tito what he was going to ask the mayor. We ran out of time, but we do have the mayor on Monday, and we want to know what you would like to know from Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. So if you have questions, join our texting group to ask them. You get started by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. You can join our texting group and tell us what you'd like to know from Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, who will be with us next Monday. And we will be back after a break. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. When the world moved online at the beginning of the pandemic, it was a huge adjustment and for some, a huge benefit. Virtual everything did make it easier for some people with disabilities to participate in community business and activities in ways that were hard or even possible before. Town hall meetings, college seminars, even doctor's visits, weddings. If you had an internet connection, you could join right from your home. Now that meetings, school, work, a lot of it are moving to being back in person, people in disability community caution that we shouldn't rush back to a normal that didn't work for everyone. Joining us now, Diana Hu, who is chairperson of the Boston Center for Independent Living. Diana, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And we also have Shruti Rajkumar, a recent graduate of Emerson's Journalism School and author of an op-ed in the Boston Globe called "The Rush to Back to Normal at College and Work is Ignoring Disabled People." Shruti, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Shruti, I'm actually going to start with you. The subheadline of your article said, "People long for the old way of doing things." For me, the old way of doing things was a nightmare. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so, I went to school in college before the pandemic started, and remote options weren't really a thing at the time, even though disabled people have been pushing for that and asking for that for years in workplaces, and I guess in college as well, I'm not quite sure. But so before the pandemic, I pretty much was going to classes every day in person, and I went to Emerson College, which was a pretty small campus, so it was pretty easy for me to get to and from my classes. But when it was snowing, I mean, we know that Boston winters are never fun. It was
and very the sidewalks are never get, clear.
Yeah, exactly. So it was very difficult for me to get to class. And most of the time, I would just go to class. I would figure out a way, even if there was black ice or it was snowing, I would still find a way. There were a couple times where if I had a professor that I really trusted, I would ask them if I could, get an excused absence. But we're only allowed a couple of those. So it's kind of difficult to, be flexible with that when you have these policies in place. So that was sort of one aspect of it. But then also, even on rainy days, it was pretty difficult for me to get to class because inside the hallways, it would be very slippery. And I've worked with administration to figure out what ways we can help students who are in those situations, like how can we clear the the floor is a little better. How can we put more carpets and things like that? But there's still a barrier in place. You know, you can't ensure that the entire floor is going to be dry all the time with people constantly walking in and out. So, you know, it was very difficult for me even on rainy days to get to my classrooms. I just always did it, though. I would always go to class and I would just try and find a way. So when remote options sort of became a thing, I was sort of able to navigate those inaccessible moments, and I would just go to class online if it was raining or snowing or whenever I felt the need, and it really worked out better for me. So with this whole push back to normal, it can be very difficult for me to reconcile with that, because I really don't want to go back to normal.
So Diana, who, let me just start by asking you how what we just heard from Shruti resonates with you and your experience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like Shruti, I'm also using a wheelchair. And definitely during the winter times with the snow out there, with the inclement weather, I've been stuck in the elements and really got my wheelchair into the thick of snow and had to rely on the kindness of strangers to sort of pull my wheelchair out and make it functional again. So these are things that you just cannot anticipate before you go out into the wild, as it were. And I feel like when people with disabilities are going about the day, you really have to try to plan ahead, and it really takes a lot of energy, time, focus to just navigate the day-to-day living, traveling, attending meetings, trying to go to work, using up spoons of energy as you go about the day. And it's a finite amount of energy that you have, and really battling with the physical world, battling with a world that was not made for people with disabilities, a world fundamentally not made for someone like me. It just takes a lot of energy to combat that. And I think the push for remote access, remote participation is one of the ways to meet that battle and level the playing field.
So I want to ask both of you, Diana and Shruti. So the pandemic hits and we move to a remote access world. And I found myself wondering, as the world made those changes and some people liked it and some people complained about it, did you feel relief that the changes the two of you had been advocating for were happening for these other reasons? Or were you angry that you'd been asking for this all along and it wasn't until we had this broader pandemic experience that the world shifted when we had the ability to do so even sooner? Shruti.
Yeah, so for me, I think I felt more of a relief because, you know, even though people have been asking for this in, you know, workplace environments, I think for disabled students, I think that we didn't really feel like we could ask for these things. And so we just never did, at least to my knowledge. I don't think a lot of people were really asking for it. At least I don't think that was something that was going on. And for me, I just felt very relieved. You know, I always say that, like, I spend my entire life trying to keep up with non-disabled people. And so the pandemic kind of forced me to rest and kind of check in with my body every single day and just be like, what do I need for myself? I think the anger started coming in when we started shifting away from remote access, because once non-disabled people didn't need it or didn't want it, it was being taken away from us. And I think that is where the grief sort of sets in. And I think the entire disabled community is going through that, because we made hybrid access work. We made remote access work because non-disabled people and everybody else needed it. But the moment when those people were done with it and they didn't care about it and they didn't want it, you know, we automatically flipped the table and we're like, we're going to cater to you now and disregard the disabled community.
Diana, excuse me, I'm really struck by Shruti's use of the word grief there. And you know, you're one of the things that you're focused on is legislation that would make things like public meetings remain accessible and with a virtual option. That enfranchisement seems really important. Talk about whether grief is the right word for you too, and what kind of response you're getting about this push to keep things accessible.
Yeah. I think there's a combination of, as Shruti said, grief, relief. I think that remote access, remote participation in meetings, virtual accessibility, that's been first and foremost an accessibility accommodation that people have been calling for in the disability community long before COVID. And it comes as sort of this pattern of universal design, of the curb cut effect, along with curb cuts, along with elevators, audiobooks, speech to text. It's all part of accessibility accommodations that have exploded into universal popularity. And that's exactly what these proposed bills to make remote access and hybrid access permanent. That's what these bills are aiming for, because this is a benefit not only to the disability community, but to mainstream society at large. Anyone, with mobility challenges, anyone who's taking care of small children, anyone who faces barriers to transportation, to leaving work in the middle of the day and just wants to tune into what their government is doing, these are all groups of people who benefit from having remote access made permanent.
And do you get warm reception for that as you're trying to get this legislation moved forward?
I think we're getting a warm reception. It seems like people are on the same page, but we just need more momentum. The legislative session is coming to a close soon, and it feels like we just need more public support. We need society at large to recognize that these benefits, these strides we've made during the pandemic, should not be reverted as the pandemic is seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. These are instances of universal design that should be here to stay for the long term. Yeah.
So Shruti, back to you now. So much of what we've talked about here is enfranchisement, participation in public life, your ability to attend and participate in your education the way that you want to. What about private life, personal life? Did aspects of that become easier for you during the pandemic? And are you worried about losing some of that accessibility as well?
Yeah, so I think for the most part, I do enjoy, you know, being in person, but with the pandemic, I obviously wanted to stay safe and I wanted to, you know, not be in person all the time. So I think remote access definitely helped in that regard. I was a part of a student disability organization at Emerson College, and all of our members are obviously disabled. And so that definitely helped us connect and continue that organization even during the pandemic. And I don't think that we would have gotten that same level of social connection had we not had remote access. And also I do have disabled friends, and so that has helped. But in the long run, I think that for me, the main benefit is when it comes to education and work environments. I think remote access definitely helps me in that way. But of course, I know that other people, some of my friends who are disabled, might feel differently. They, in social situations, they might benefit from having virtual settings. I know one of my closest friend feels usually better when it's virtual, especially during the pandemic. So I definitely want to make sure that she is feeling safe and that we are able to interact with one another even during the pandemic and afterwards in a way that's accessible to her.
And Diana, you talked a minute ago about the universal benefit of some measures that we've taken in the past, like curb cuts, those drops and curbs at intersections, which make it easier, for example, to bring a wheelchair through, but also a stroller or a grocery cart through. What else do you want people to understand that they may not, if they're not a member of the disability community themselves, about what the pandemic has created and how back to normal isn't good for everyone?
Yeah, it's sort of an ironic twist that it was during pandemic that I felt my personal energy levels, I felt my personal productivity actually flourish a bit in My home environment, this is the most optimized environment for my needs and my accessibility sort of accommodations. And that's really enabled a higher level of energy for me during the day. I've attended more meetings than ever before. I attended my first legislative hearing in the midst of the pandemic. I'm able to connect better with my friends. I'm able to have more energy throughout the day. These are sorts of energy boosts that virtual access has brought about. And I think, just acknowledging that increased energy, that optimal flexibility for people with disabilities and beyond, that's afforded by hybrid access. I think this is something that we need to make permanent. And I think it's hard as a mainstream society wants to go back to some form of new normal now, but I think we have to account for new normal allowing for remote access.
All right, and that is Diana Hu, chairperson of the Boston Center for Independent Living, along with Shruti Rajkumar, a recent Emerson graduate who wrote an opinion piece in the Boston Globe. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That piece is called Heroes. It is a composition by Julius Williams, professor at Berklee College of Music and the first African-American president of the American Conductors Guild. Williams wrote the piece as part of the rededication of one of the nation's best-known Civil War monuments, which sits on Boston Common. Originally unveiled on May 31st, 1897, it commemorates Robert Gould Shaw and the 54th Regiment. It was the first all-black volunteer regiment in the Union Army, although Robert Gould Shaw, son of local abolitionists, was white. Professor Julius Williams joins us on the line now. Julius, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I understand you're out on the West Coast and got up a little extra early to do this, so I appreciate
it. Yes. Well, I'm still on the East Coast time, so it's okay. It's fine.
Excellent. There is so much historical weight to the story of the 54th Regiment, to what they mean to the country, to what they mean to the region. How do you sit down and craft a piece of music that does honor to that history? What was in the front of your mind?
Well, first I was a little nervous as I was composing it right in the middle of the pandemic. And it was a little bit, you know, when I saw the weight of this story about these regiment run by two white officers, and the whole regiment was all black. And this was during the Civil War. It was kind of daunting, and I had to figure out how to you know, have it come across. What happened? They had to fight, and of course, they were obviously slaughtered if they didn't move through. But they were a strong regiment, and they fought for their freedom, which is the biggest thing. They fought to be free in a country that didn't let them be free, and so it was a real daunting task. And I had to figure out, you know, thinking about the movie Glory, I remember.
1989.
In 1989 with the Boys Choir of Harlem was the choir that sung in the background of many of the scenes in that particular movie. I knew the director very well, and I thought, that's an idea. How can I make this come across in a short amount of time? And they told me I was going to have the Boston Children's Chorus to be to have this come across. So that was a little interesting. But the next step was to find some words for this.
If you don't mind, I'd love to take just a moment, Professor Williams, and play just a touch more of the music. Here it is.
Each dying heart, each dying heart, each dying heart.
Hear
the wounded nation's cry.
So there's the choir, as you mentioned, and you were just talking about the words that you chose. Some come from a poem by Frederick Douglass, some by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. So talk a little bit more about that now that our listeners can put it all together in their heads.
Right. Well, Frances Ellen Watkins was she was an author, she was a poet, she was a lecturer. And, you know, this was, you know, she was born in 1825 in Baltimore. She happened to be, one of the, she was born of free African parents. But she was a oddity in that moment because she was becoming a black intellectual woman in the North, writing poetry and writing things about life. And she was and she co-founded the National Association of Colored Women. So she was a abolitionist, a suffragette, and as a black woman before the Civil War, which was amazing. So I looked at her words, and then, of course, the words of Frederick Douglass. And I had to, and I wanted to get a little bit of their statement of this Civil War. And then that's when I took the text from for the kids.
And my last question for you, Professor Julius Williams, what is the feeling you want people left with when they're done listening to your composition?
Well, the feeling I want is that I put a sound of marching. You can feel they're going, but they're fighting for their freedom. In that last clip that you played, they're talking about going towards I'm fighting to be a real person. Before that, you know, African Americans were classified as, in one sense, one third of a real person. So they're fighting to be people. They're fighting to be free. They're fighting to own land. They're fighting to have a family without being taken apart. So this was very important. And also fighting in this sense to be, you know, considered men. So it was a very, daunting task to write and to put in a piece, and that's what I was trying to get across.
Well, Maestro Julius Williams is a professor at the Berklee College of Music and the first African-American president of the American Conductors Guild. The name of the piece is Heroes. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
So we want to dive here in Studio 2 now more into the history of the 54th Regiment and Robert Gould Shaw. Joining us here in the studio, Professor Carrie Greenidge of Tufts University. She's also the historian in residence at the Museum of African American History in Boston. Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, reactions to what we just heard from Julius Williams.
It was so beautiful. And I was actually at the rededication ceremony a few days ago, and the choir performed it. And so I just wanted to say congratulations to Professor Williams. It's wonderfully done, and incorporating all the history is pretty impressive.
So tell us a little bit about the history of this regiment.
The history of the Massachusetts 54th Regiment is that it's organized in early 1863 on the heels of the ratification of the Emancipation Proclamation. And that proclamation was issued on January 1st, 1863. And it provided for freedom for enslaved people in rebelling areas of the South. And one of the provisions in there was to allow African Americans to enlist in the United States military. And so Massachusetts at the time was a home to a very vibrant, politically activist, abolitionist black community, as well as a supportive and allied white community. And that community rallied around the idea of creating a regiment that would come from Massachusetts and be able to be the first federally organized to go into the South. And the governor of the state at the time, Governor John Andrew, organized the 54th Massachusetts Regiment because of the small population of African American people in Boston and in New England. The regiment then had to call for enlistees from throughout the African diaspora.
Interesting.
So you had black people from all over the country. There's evidence of people from Haiti and the Caribbean arriving in Boston to enlist in this regiment. And so many people volunteered, over 1,000, that Massachusetts then created the 55th Regiment to accommodate all the volunteers.
And they put Robert Gould Shaw in charge, for lack of a better word, of this regiment. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the one of the caveats for African-American enlistment was that the regiment would be led by white men. Specifically, the Wards were anti-slavery white men who would lead the regiment. And the Shaw family was a family of reformers. Robert Gould was a young man who had lived in New York City, had attended university, and he's called upon by his parents to sort of volunteer his services to this regiment. He and the other officers were all white men, but in the course of them fighting in the South, and particularly in the course of them making their way down to Fort Wagner, South Carolina in July 1863, many of those white officers, the impact of the 54th Regiment changed the way that they viewed African-American men's capability in the war, influenced the way that even somebody like a Robert Gould Shaw viewed the men he was put in charge of.
So many do know the 1989 movie Glory, which told this story. A lot of famous actors, Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, Andre Brower. If there are pieces of the narrative that weren't in that story that we need to know.
Yes, yes, there are. There are many of them. One of the stories is that this was really a project of the black abolitionist community in Boston. As early as the 1850s, black Bostonians like William Nell organized to try to get some type of recognition and inclusion of black men in the local state militia. You had as early as 1861, many black Bostonians like William Wells Brown, who was in Boston at the time, arguing the black community should take a lead in helping to enlist soldiers. And so one of the stories that we should remember is that this really is something that's on behalf of the black community, as was the organization of the Shaw Memorial and 54th Regiment. A very famous African-American caterer in Boston named Joshua Bowen Smith was one of the black men who really pushed the idea of creating some type of monument to Shaw and to the black men who fought. And he was one of the first in 1865 to start to take the pulse of the black community to figure out what the feasibility of making the monument was. And so I would say that one of the stories we need to tell is this group of Bostonians, led by black Bostonians, who eventually ended up creating the will and the excitement around creating the monument in 1883.
So I think there's no spoiler here, right? Because this is history. It's not fiction where we're giving away the end. But there is a lot of loss.
Yes.
And tell about that.
So the regiment fought at the Battle of Fort Wagner, South Carolina, July 18th, 1863. That occurred at a moment when the Union Army was, militarily losing the war. The men arrived to attack Fort Wagner, South Carolina, and they ended up losing, out of their 1,000 men, losing over 459 members of their troop. And so devastating loss. The effects of that were also that Robert Gould Shaw himself was killed in battle. And actually, his body was not returned to his family because of the intense racism and hatred towards him as a white man leading a black regiment. The regiment did not end up seizing Fort Wagner on that day. But the significance of that battle is that it changed the tide, number one, of the views that Americans had of black Union soldiers. So this is at a period where there is these stereotypes that black men cannot fight, that they cannot, if they were given weapons and they were allowed to fight, that they would be vengeful towards white people. And so despite all of the loss, despite all of the death, it became a symbol of African-American pride and really pride for the Union Army and for Massachusetts.
So now let's talk about the memorial itself, because it's interesting. So artist Augustus St. Gaudens makes the memorial. For those who haven't seen it, Robert Gould Shaw is in front on a horse. The soldiers are walking kind of in a relief in back. My understanding is that it was the first time an artist had used African-American models and sought to depict them accurately. We do still have the white leader in front, right, and the soldiers in back. Where does it sit in sort of the pantheon of how we remember the moments of the Civil War?
Well, I will turn to David Blight was at the rededication a couple of days ago, the famous historian. And one of the things he said is it's the most spectacular monument to the Civil War that's been created. Augustus St. Gaudens, as you pointed out, made sure that this would not reflect racial stereotype at the time. He actually recruited black men to pose for him and made over 40 busts of heads of African-American men so that it would look like them. If you look at the relief, you can see kind of the movement of it, the feet that shows the depth of the soldiers who were actually involved in the 54th Regiment. And so there's a lot of depth. There's a lot of I go by there all the time, and I always see a different kind of detail within the men's faces and within the detail of honoring the fact that this was a black regiment. Robert Goldshaw is on the horse because he is the colonel, but that this is a black regiment and showing the depth and the breadth of black participation in the 54th.
So you've made a couple of references to the rededication ceremony, which did happen earlier this week. And I want to give a little sound to you. This is Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. He's speaking at the event. And to provide context, he's speaking about the legacy of Abraham Lincoln as the great emancipator and how the 54th Regiment had an equally important part to play in emancipation. Here it is.
They're a testament to we freed us. There was not a single person who abolished slavery. It was a communal affair. It was a national affair. It was something we did together. Black people and white people, enslaved and free, North and South. Most of the monuments in this city, across the Commonwealth, even throughout the United States, honor a single person. But this monument, the Shaw 54th Regimental Memorial, honors a community marching courageously.
That feels like a call to action today.
Yes, very much so. I would say that the beauty of the monument itself is that it is not based on one person. Walking by and looking at the detail, it's showing sort of the marching feet, the depth, the numbers of muskets that you can see rendered in the bas relief. It's creating this call to action and this idea that freedom and emancipation are the project of multiple people and not just one person, and specifically during the Civil War, that African American soldiers and communities played an integral role in achieving that first phase of freedom.
And sort of last question to you, if I almost imagine a golden thread from the 54th Regiment through to today, and I'm looking carefully out in the world and I see a little glimmer of that thread, where's one place that that legacy glimmers today?
I think it glimmers in the ways in which average people, black communities, groups of average working black people and brown people and disenfranchised people are able to affect political and cultural monumental change, even if at the moment they're not acknowledged for doing that. And so I think the lesson of the 54th Memorial is, with all those feet passing through, is that the power of the community and the power of multiple groups of people in a battle that can often feel like it privileges the single person.
Wow. All right. That is Professor Kerry Greenidge, the Mellon Assistant Professor in the Department of Studies in Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University, and the author of Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter. She's also historian in residence at the Museum of African American History in Boston. This was a great conversation, and we will link to what was also a fantastic conversation about Black Radical on our webpage, radioboston.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
It is here, finally, and after thumping the Warriors in Game 1 last night, the Celtics don't play again until Sunday at 8. So if you are suddenly finding yourself with free time this weekend and you're unsure how to spend it, WBUR Assistant Managing Editor of Arts and Culture, Tanya Raleigh, has some suggestions. Welcome, Tanya.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. So are you ready for The Weeknd?
I am ready for The Weeknd. I think that we're going to have some gorgeous weather, so there's a lot to get out and do.
And you brought us all arts-oriented activities, some indoors, some outdoors for The Weeknd. So let's just jump right in, and I think you're taking us first to Coolidge Corner in Brookline.
Yes, that's right. So after a 2-year hiatus, the Coolidge Corner Arts Festival is back. This is a great street festival. It features 75 artists from around New England, and they are working in a variety of different mediums. You'll see photography, glass art, fiber arts, jewelry. The jury prize this year has been awarded to painter Liz Prescott. She is a painter. She works in Maine, and she does these really gorgeous abstract paintings, or they look abstract. They're actually landscape paintings. She captures the Maine coast, and she just has these really loose brush strokes. Her colors are lush, and her work is going to be at the festival.
All right, and that's Saturday, 11 to 6, and it's free, yes?
That's right, and there's going to be a live DJ. There will be food trucks. So it should be a great outdoor event.
Especially since you just mentioned we're also going to get great weather. So it does sound like a good time to be outdoors. All right. But yeah, we do have something next for the kids. I think it's puppets.
That's right. Exactly. So Puppet Showplace Theater it's a Brookline institution, and they are celebrating their 48th birthday. Usually they have their shows at their storefront theater space in Brookline Village. This weekend, they're going to have a series of workshops and performances in Emerson Garden in Brookline. There's going to be a craft table for kids. They can make their own puppets, a balloon twisting workshop. I don't know if you've ever tried that.
It always yes, and they are popped and it hurt.
Yes, exactly. I know. I think I've tried to make sort of like a little wiener dog before, and it was unsuccessful.
Yeah.
But they're going to have some puppet shows too. Puppeteer Harry Lacoste is putting on a show called The Caboose is Loose. It's for kids 2 to 6. There are going to be some other performances, and the whole thing will culminate in a big puppet parade late in the afternoon.
Okay, that does sound like a lot of fun. Now you're going to give us something a little more serious. We're going to go to the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. And this is a production of the musical 1776. Tell us about that.
That's right. So the musical centers on John Adams' frustration of living under British rule. So it's sort of like this pivotal moment, and he's trying to persuade members of the Continental Congress to join him and vote in favor of American independence. He wants them to sign a declaration, which we, of course, know is the Declaration of Independence, and it's the one, you know, ultimately written by Thomas Jefferson. And this is not a new production. It's been around since the 60s. In 1969, it actually beat Hair for Best Musical at the Tony Awards. Huh. But what's new about it is the way in which ART, Artistic Director Diane Paulus, has casted the show. She has pulled together a really dynamic cast of racially diverse actors. They identify as female, non-binary, and trans. And what it just, it makes, I mean, sort of as you're watching, you know, this moment so many of us learned about in school, it just makes you rethink, you know, who the founding fathers were and who they were including and who they were leaving out. And it's moving. Adams is, he's pushing, and he wants to know what people are his fellow members are willing to sacrifice for freedom from England. And, you know, it just comes at a really high cost. One of the production members, Anika Phillips, she's talked about this.
So we are going to have to wrap there. I know you had originally brought us some sound, Tanya, that we could have heard about there, but I think we're going to have to wrap. 3 really fun things to do this weekend. I appreciate that. And I am going to ask you, 8 o'clock Sunday night, are you going to watch the Celtics?
Absolutely. Yeah, after yesterday,
that's
I will.
Right. Go green. Okay, that was Tanya Rowley, Assistant Managing Editor for Arts and Culture at WBUR. Thanks so much. Great things to do
this
weekend.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.